agenda for today, Mr. Test.
It's going to be kind of a busy day, Mr. Chairman. First, we have a follow-up or a finish-off from last session with Oregon Department of Agriculture, telling their role within the Oregon plan. Then we'll have presentations that will introduce themselves to two of the groups that work as liaison with legislature, the Healthy Streams Partnership, Salmon Recovery Task Force. Then we'll talk to a couple of the implementation organizations that are local, so water districts and watershed councils. And then hear from three of the stakeholders or stakeholder organizations, OFIC, Oregon Trout, and Oregon Farm Bureau. Probably have a slight change in schedule and have OFIC presentation right after Department of Agriculture finished with theirs. And that will be a long day, probably longer than we hope to get done, but hopefully everybody will be brief and we can get the information to our committee members.
Thank you, Pete. And let me, for the committee, make one announcement. You have, I think, in the materials that Pete has handed out to you, a special joint meeting with the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resource, Senate Committee on Water and Land Use, this House Committee on Natural Resources, House Committee on Trade and Economic Development, and the House Committee on Water. A meeting tomorrow, Wednesday, the 5th, in Hearing Room C. And I recognize that some of us may have conflicts in our schedules, but I would encourage you, if you have and can make the time to attend this meeting. It will have to do with the Columbia River and the use of the Columbia River for both irrigation and transportation. And just so there's no misunderstanding, you'd understand that the Columbia River, to the chair, is an extremely vital part of his area of the state and serves both the economic, agricultural economic activities as well as transportation. So if it is possible for you to be there, we would genuinely appreciate your being there. I think it should be very informational for us. Is there anything else that should be talking about before we start here and bring up Chuck Craig with the Department of Agriculture?
Well, he's on his way up. Just note, committee, I gave you some specifics on the field trip for Thursday. We'll have more specifics in the agenda for Thursday today, but you've got a little note of things to remember and time and place. And I think Representative Dingfelder had a quick thing.
Mr. Chair, before we get started today, we have a little, this was a get well present, but now it's a welcome back present. Well, something for you from the committee to help you ease into your transition. And it's not a bottle of whiskey, but it'll help. And we missed you, and we're really, really happy to have you back.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was tough. You know, Jeff and I really had to keep this committee together. And
this is a wild bunch, yeah. Mr. Chair. You have to understand.
I appreciate that a lot. You know, especially look at the ladies on the other end down there. I mean, it looked to me like it'd be pretty hard to keep them going and under control. So thank you.
I think I resemble that.
You do.
Here, here.
Oh, all right. Well, that's caution. Do not cut. at least the experience that I had, I would have. I am glad they didn't have that. Do not cut on my on my chest. I'd have hated to have had them tear through it.
Thank you.
Oh, very nice. Thank you very much. So.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Well, we want you to use it in good health, and we're thrilled to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Talk about cutting edge with your life.
Okay. Well, let's leave the cutting go for a while, all right? Excuse me, Mr. Craig, and Mr. Deb, how are you this morning? If you wanted to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Chuck Craig. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Agriculture, and with me is Ray Jandel, the Assistant Administrator of our Natural Resources Division. Glad to be here to talk to you about the ODA's role in the Oregon Plan, but Mr. Chair, before I begin, I just wanted to extend to you a very warm welcome back from the whole Department of Agriculture. You've always been a good friend of ours, and we're very glad that you're back and in good condition. And
thank you very much, Chuck. Appreciate it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, ODA fulfills its responsibilities in the Oregon Plan through four primary areas. It's a state lead agency for developing and implementing so-called Senate Bill 1010 agricultural water management area plans. It's also the lead agency for livestock water quality, the so-called CAFO program for confined animal feeding operations. We also do lead work for weeds and invasive species, and we have a unique relationship with soil and water conservations and the Federal Ag Services Agencies and Extension Service, which form sort of a partnership for the agricultural community that has been a very effective mechanism over the years to provide technical and financial assistance to landowners. This slide helps me segue into Senate Bill 1010. This is obviously an example of a fairly straightforward practice in a vineyard on fairly steep ground to control erosion and prevent water pollution. Senate Bill 1010 plans generally have as a goal to prevent and control water pollution from agricultural activities and soil erosion and to achieve applicable water quality standards. Senate Bill 1010 plans are rather comprehensive, adaptive management types of plans that there's a long list of things they have to contain. I think you have this in your handout, and I won't spend much time on it, but the key things I think about Senate Bill 1010 plans from a philosophical standpoint is, one, they're outcomes-based rather than practice-based. They're non-prescriptive. We don't tell people how to achieve the outcomes, but allow them to select the things that will work best for them on their land and their site. They're watershed-based, and they emphasize voluntary actions and incentives up front, but there's a regulatory backstop in the end to deal with folks that just decide they won't go along with the program. Current status of...
Mr. Chair, before we move off that, the non-prescriptive, it's non-prescriptive kind of, but it's non-prescriptive within a list of approved practices, isn't that correct, basin by basin?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, certainly what happens most frequently is a landowner goes to the Soil and Water District or to NRCS to get technical help, and there's a reference to practices that exist in sort of a compendium of technical work that NRCS does, we don't necessarily require any of those practices. If someone can demonstrate an alternative practice that provides an equal degree of water quality protection, that's acceptable to us too. But I think you're right in the sense that we look at this as sort of a menu from which landowners can choose if they don't have another idea that they think is better. But if someone can propose something to us and give us data or reason to believe it would be more effective than the known practices, we'll give it a shot.
Yeah, but I guess the point was that when a basin develops their 10-10 plan, they identify the problems, and then they come up with a list of things that could be done, clearly a menu of mm-hmm. different things that could be done to achieve the solution. And as long as the landowner is within that universe, it's fairly simple. If he's going to go outside of that, then he's got to go through another avenue to get approval. Wouldn't that be correct?
I think, you know, we have provision in our plans for people to provide us with information.
Right,
that shows.
But clearly, if I am dealing with quality issue X, and the way I choose to deal with it is number three on the list of things to deal with quality issue X, it's pretty much a done thing. It's accepted because it's part of the plan.
Yeah.
And I guess the point is it is narrowed to a degree with the ability to go around it, but then that gets you into some more steps to get there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Rep. Cruz, you're right. I mean, if it's an established and accepted practice, there's no question about it. If it isn't, there's some evaluation that goes on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of wanted a definition there.
Just as for the Chair's information, on this, because I think Representative Cruz brings up an important point, does the department have any illustrations or examples where individuals have chosen to go around, if you wish, the prescribed menu, and those things have been found to be acceptable?
Mr. Chair, I can't think of an example I can explain easily to you right now. I can tell you, though, that there have been cases where groups of farmers have come to the department and said, look, NRCS has sort of promulgated this practice in this area that doesn't really work for us. It's not practical. And we've listened and helped them come up with an alternative, but basically within the system, alternatives within the system. I can't give you an example of a person that's gone out and invented a new best management practice right now. I'd have to go back and look and see what I could find. But
I think this is I think Representative Cruz has brought up really an important point, because oftentimes we talk about being flexibility in programs that we have, and then when it gets down to the flexibility, it seems sometimes, or maybe more often than not, to the users that there isn't the flexibility. So if you could, I really would appreciate it. And I'm not interested in really all of the technical detail or that sort of thing, but of some illustrations where people have come up with some good ideas that has provided the flexibility that Representative Cruz is alluding to, or the need for that. Thank you.
Mr. Clark, just to follow up just a little bit more, I'm assuming that one of the resources that's used here, and I think one that you folks recognize, is NRCS's field tech guide, which is a pretty good resource. But would I be correct in assuming, off the example you used, I mean, one of the things in that tech guide that's never really fit with Oregon, for example, is their mathematical formulas for arriving at T. And I mean, that's clearly a Midwest model, and it doesn't fit here. Are those some of the issues that farmers raise as more from that perspective?
I, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's one of the things that usually comes up is the inapplicability of the universal soil loss equation in certain conditions, and we provide for alternative mechanisms for that in the plans.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, the current status of Senate Bill 1010 plans around the state is that we've established 39 planning areas in consultation with DEQ that correspond well with their basins. 24 of them have plans and rules adopted currently. 6 are in the public hearing adoption stage, and the remaining 9 have advisory committees meeting with final adoption expected by the end of next year. And I'd say about half of those 9 are actually about ready to go to the public hearing review stage at any point in time. So things have moved along pretty well. From this map, you can see the areas in blue and green are plans adopted and plans in public review, and the pink are areas that have advisory committee meeting, and this map is rapidly getting filled in with blue.
Mr. Chair,
back to the map. I'm assuming the gray areas are tribal lands.
Yes.
Is there any work towards bringing them into this, or are we going to just leave them totally separate?
Chair, Representative Cruz, my name is Ray Jandl. I'm with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Assistant Administrator. And the tribal lands develop their own TMDLs, implementation plans, as separate governments. So they are doing that themselves with DEQ.
Okay, I guess, Mr. Chair, the point is that they, and I understand they're doing that, but that should be part of the matrix at some point in time. We've worked very hard to integrate what we've been doing with the tribes. I'd hate to see them off on a separate universe in relation to 1010, you know, when all said and done. So.
Mr. Chair, so far the results to date are a substantial increase in landowner knowledge and participation. There are definitely measurable improvements in water quality in basins where we have detailed monitoring data. This example from the Tualatin showing the increase in dissolved oxygen content and the gradual decline in stream temperatures that are occurring. We also have to say, even if we're bragging a little bit, that the program has demonstrated an outstanding success of local soil and water conservation districts as local management agencies for the program, and because of our relationship with them, we have a very strong preference for implementing this program at the local level through the SWCDs. Just an example with a couple numbers here. You can see the number of landowners that have been contacted and the outreach activities, which are workshops and seminars and meetings and so forth about conservation practices and ways that landowners can help improve water quality. The numbers are impressive. It's also clear from this, if you study it, that there's a bottleneck, and that has to do with our ability to provide technical assistance to everybody that needs it in a timely way. Turning now to our role in the confined animal feeding operations program, if you recall, the last session of the legislature substantially expanded the department's responsibilities in the CAFO program. Oregon law was expanded to include regulation of operations that were covered by the federal regulations, which include a lot of livestock operations such as cattle operations, sheep, and so forth. We had to adopt new rules, which we did, that encompassed those federal requirements, and we're very close now to adopting a federally accepted CAFO permit for all operations in Oregon. We've had a very substantial outreach effort with the Extension Service. We've had nearly 20 meetings statewide to talk to people about what these requirements are and try to get everybody on track. And then finally, we are inspecting every permitted CAFO once a year with our statewide staff now. And we have 6 geographic areas that cover the state and 1 inspector for each of those areas. And that is making a tremendous amount of difference in having that continual daily presence on the ground in those areas and developing the relationships with the landowners that are necessary to get into sort of a mode of continuous improvement as opposed to just being there to respond when something goes wrong.
So, Mr. Chair, so CAFO is no longer complaint-driven?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's correct. Okay. It's not complaint-driven any longer. We respond to complaints when we get them, but that's not the primary driver for the activities in the
program.
And that's
basically because of the new federal law.
Right.
Thank you.
This slide is of a purple loosestrife infestation in an area called Simplot Meadows in Ontario, and it's illustrative of the impact that noxious weeds can have on watershed function, particularly sensitive watershed function. It's only been in probably in the last 10 years that people have really understood the profound impact that weeds can have on watershed function, and we're not talking here about dandelions in your yard or common crop weeds. These are highly invasive noxious weeds that can take over and crowd out native plants and adversely affect habitat. So, in this area, we've developed a statewide strategic plan for controlling noxious weeds with a very, very broad group of stakeholders, and there's also a group that is connected with that effort now that is seeking to enhance the resources that go into noxious weed and invasive species control statewide. We can coordinate very closely with our state and federal partners. We do work and consultation with other agencies such as BLM, Forest Service, ODOT, to help either directly do weed control work or help them do weed control work on their land. And then,
Chair, could you tell me how helpful or active the federal partners are in their controlling of these noxious weeds on federal lands?
Mr. Chair, I think that they're very concerned about it, and they work with us as best they can with the resources they have at the state level to do what they can. Given the number of federal lands and some of the other constraints that exist in the management of those lands,
it just strikes me, colleagues, that we have more federal land, I think, in the state of Oregon than almost any other state. And if we're going to get a handle, keep a handle on the noxious weeds, the federal land has to be managed as well as the rest of our land. And I know that's not necessarily your responsibility. I'm just trying to get an idea or an understanding of how active their participation is, and whether or not there's anything that this committee might be able to do to work something up through the process. If they're not active, work something up through the process to get more activity out of them on it.
Mr. Chair, I think they are active. I wouldn't say their efforts are adequate necessarily to deal with the magnitude of the problem. As you point out, 52% of the land in Oregon is federally owned, and there are tremendous issues with weed populations on some of those lands that need to be dealt with. But we've had very good relationship with federal agencies.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, has Japanese knotweed, has that become more of a problem in the last few years?
Do you know that one? Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not familiar specifically with that weed. We can find out for you from someone in the weed program that knows these things.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Cruz.
Chuck, how many counties currently have viable weed programs? Do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think it's about 15 or 16 counties. It's less than half.
And how do they fit in your matrix?
I was about to get to that.
Okay.
If you recall, a couple sessions ago, the legislature provided the department with additional funds to largely that we pass on through the state weed board to the county weed control districts to control weeds at the local level. Those are Measure 66 funds, and we've done over 150 grants totaling like $1.7 million. But we have a state weed board in the Department of Ag that serves as kind of the liaison for the local weed control districts and provides funding and other support for them as best we can. The strategic plan that was developed by the department calls for strengthening those local weed control boards and actually the group that's out trying to develop some support for enhanced resources for weed control is trying to get support for additional support for the local weed control programs.
Chuck, don't want to rush you, and I know I have another question here, but we are running up against the timeline, and so if you would very quickly, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of these noxious weeds are not indigenous to Oregon. What are we doing anything to prevent new ones from being brought in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, yes, we keep track of them. We have a list of the kind of the 100 worst invaders that we want to keep out of Oregon, and we actually grade ourselves on how well we do in keeping new ones out as opposed to just controlling ones that are already here. But we're constantly doing surveys and early detection efforts to try to intercede on those invaders that would get here and try to establish a foothold.
Okay, if you could try to summarize, Chuck, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Look, you know.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to just jump ahead to slide on where we're going. We're shifting our role now from one of sort of developing new regulatory programs to implementing programs with the idea of facilitating the delivery of maximum financial and technical assistance to farmers and ranchers. We're pursuing enhanced soil and water district capacity and effectiveness in delivering technical assistance. We are also continuing to work on 4D protection issues with a cluster of soil and water conservation districts, state and federal agencies, and we're getting more and more, I think, interested in habitat protection as a subject that the department is involved in directly as opposed to indirectly. And finally, Mr. Chair, just to wrap it up, I would say that we feel it's important to stay the course that we're on. We're seeing positive results. There's been a terrific response in terms of voluntary efforts by farmers and ranchers. There are measurable water quality improvements, and it's a truly Oregon approach.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for the panel? Appreciate your testimony here before us this morning, Chuck, and it's good to see you. Look forward to a productive session this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At this time, we're going to change the agenda slightly to accommodate Mr. Ray Wilkerson, the legislative director for OFIC. He has another meeting that he needs to get to, and he's here at pretty much our request, so we'll try to keep going. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your juggling the schedule. I'm Ray Wilkerson of the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and by way of background for some of the newer members of the committee, perhaps, we represent private forest landowners in Oregon, primarily the larger owners, which is has various definitions, but one common one is larger than 5,000 acres. So our members include corporations such as Weyerhaeuser and Boise Cascade, but the majority of our members are privately held family businesses, some of whom have been around the state for generations and continue to manage their forest land, hopefully in perpetuity. So that's who we are. Right off the top, I'll tell you we've been a strong supporter of the Oregon plan since its inception. We think it's been good all the way around. It's been good for us legally. It's been good for the state, I think, in terms of state sovereignty, and it's been good for the fish. I think what we've done under the Oregon plan has been much more beneficial for salmon than the alternatives that were available through the federal processes. Just about a little bit of history, if I could, and I'll be quick. We were approached by the Governor Kitzhaber early on in 1995, early in his administration, and basically at that time some petitions had been filed to list salmon species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the governor thought that Oregon ought to come up with an alternative to that, because the thinking at the time was that, unlike the spotted owl, for example, which was a federally listed species, the habitat was much more complex for salmon. Spotted owl is basically forests, and you can, using a command and control federal regulatory approach, you can impose some things on that habitat that are pretty significant. But with salmon, you've got multiple ownerships, you've got multiple types of ownerships. It's forestry, it's ag, it's municipal, it's urban, estuaries, ocean, obviously. So the ESA is a kind of a blunt club for that kind of a species, and not likely to be very effective in accomplishing its objectives. That was the thinking. So Oregon embarked on an effort to come up with an Oregon plan instead that was based on two things: an existing regulatory baseline such as the Oregon Forest Practices Act or the Senate Bill 1010 plans that was just described for agriculture, plus voluntary measures. And I think the real key is to the plan, and the reason I think it's been successful, we have, through whatever alchemy or whatever, we have been able to motivate people to get involved because they want to, because it's the right thing to do. And the ESA is very good at stopping you from doing something. It can tell you can't cut down this tree because it's got a bird in it that's listed, but it can't force you to plant a tree. I think in terms of the salmon plan, a better example would be culverts and roads. Representative Tomei asked a question about, why are we spending all this money on roads at a previous hearing, and the response was, we're not building new roads, we're fixing old roads. And previously, 30, 40 years ago, we used forest landowners used to build what they call mid-slope roads. They just cut a road right across the face of a steep slope and just pitch the excess dirt off to the side. It's called side cast. Well, we know now that that's not a very good idea, and we build roads differently now. But the problem is that side cast is just a mass of material. When it rains, it's likely to slide, and it's, when it slides, it's likely to get into a stream. So we don't do that anymore, but it was legal at the time, and so we cannot, the law, the state, the government cannot force us to do anything about that because we didn't break any laws, and it was and culverts are the same way. There's fish passage problems with culverts, and you can't force somebody to replace a culvert that was legally installed at the time under the standards that were state of the art at the time it was. But voluntarily, you can ask people, you know, this, if you were willing to do this, you could really do a good thing for the fish. And that's what's basically what's happening. I mean, those are forest examples, but there's other examples, and a lot of examples in other areas. In 1997, the legislature basically codified the Oregon Plan and passed a couple of bills to put it into state law. And then there was a funding issue, and OFIC stepped forward, and it was right after Measure 47, I think, and there was some real budget issues and questions, and we agreed to temporarily help get the plan off the ground financially by agreeing to a temporary increase in our timber harvest tax. We also agreed to look at our rules. The basis for the plan was the regulatory baseline was a baseline, and the governor and others weren't asking us to accept additional regulations, but negotiations with the National Marine Fisheries Service, we agreed to a process to at least assess whether or not our current forest practice standards that are applied were adequate or not, and we went through that. Unfortunately, a year later, in 1998, the coastal coho were listed anyway because of a lawsuit. Basically, the judge concluded that the National Marine Fisheries Service couldn't preclude a listing based on relying on a state plan that was just kind of in its embryonic stage at that point. So that was unfortunate. We and everybody else could have just bailed at that point and said, you know, some of the cynics, I think, thought that was the only reason the timber industry was interested in doing this was to avoid ESA. And we failed. We didn't avoid ESA. And the cynics thought, well, that's the end of the timber industry's interest in this. Well, it wasn't. We did not abandon the Oregon Plan. We stayed with it and have continued to since that time, both in terms of the voluntary measures and assessing our regulatory baseline. Some of the OWEB passed out some material last week with some statistics in it for our sector. For the larger forest landowners over a five-year period, we have done 3,600 voluntary restoration projects. Those include in-stream restoration, putting rocks and boulders and logs to create complex habitat in-stream, and also rehabilitating these older roads and culverts and that sort of thing. We have spent almost entirely out of pocket for the large forest landowners. We don't go to OWEB. We're able to rely on our own resources to cover the costs of these projects, but we've spent about, according to OWEB reporting, $48 million over 5 years. So, and most of that, again, has come since the salmon were listed anyway. So I think that shows that, you know, we have our commitment to this plan is for reasons other than just trying to avoid listings, and it continues. Just another comment. There was some discussion last week about the monitoring and that sort of thing. One of the criticisms of the Oregon Plan is that it's kind of random, and there's no process to determine that the money, Measure 66 grants or whatever, is being spent in an effective way to make sure we're getting the most bang for our buck. I think that was valid assessment early on with the plan, but I think it's much more sophisticated now. The watershed assessment process, the process used to establish priorities for funding projects, and the way we do monitoring is it's really kind of state of the art. And I don't think there's certainly no other place in the country that is trying to make sure that, you know, we effectively deal with these problems as well and with the kind of resources as Oregon has. That includes forest land. There's a lot of data, a lot of monitoring going on in forest land. We're not afraid of data. We think that we're providing pretty good habitat, and the more information we have, the better off we're going to be. What gets us is if people can make allegations and charges that you're doing something bad, and we don't have the data to refute it. So the more data, the better. Appreciated Representative Schaffler's comment at the last week about the fact that, acknowledging the fact that private landowners allow access to their land for monitoring, and we do. If ODF&W wants to come in and do something, I don't think there's a private forest landowner in the state that would say, no, I don't want you on my land. We welcome that kind of partnership.
Great. We're pushing the clock a little bit.
I'll wrap up.
Thank you, sir.
right now, I think, fast forward to the present, we are at another point of transition, just like we were when the listings occurred. The transition is the fact that we've got a new governor. The previous governor, whatever your opinion of him, right, wrong, or indifferent, he had a passion for this issue. The level of commitment from the new governor, I have no reason to think it's not there, but we don't know. And he's just getting started. And so I think we're at a critical point where the Oregon plan, if we're not careful, could kind of wither away. When Jim Brown was here, the governor's natural resource advisor, he circulated a letter to you, or copies of a letter that were written by Kitzhaber and Kulongoski to the National Marine Fisheries Service, basically asked them to indemnify the Oregon Salmon Plan through the 4D rule mechanism, which is a complicated legal point, but it is available under the ESA, and it is a way the federal government can say to Oregon, we really appreciate what you've done, and we're going to legally, tell you that as long as you keep doing it, that you're going to be, you don't have to worry about any kind of enforcement action from us. That's a big order. That's going to take a lot of work on our part, the state, and the National Marine Fisheries Service also, but I think it can be done. There's some things that are very unique about the Oregon plan. The Measure 66 funding, dedicated lottery dollars for these projects, our land use planning system means we're not converting a lot of forest land or ag land to asphalt, which is a horrible salmon habitat. The local watershed councils are unique in the country. So I think we've got a good story to tell, and this plan deserves to be rewarded and acknowledged by the federal government. If it's not, I'm afraid it could wither away. But, so we're committed to that process. We need to stay the course, and we need to work both with the state and with the federal government, which I think at the top level of the current federal administration, they want to do this. I think they really do believe that what Oregon has done is unique and ought to be kind of a poster child for the rest of the country for statewide conservation planning. But the politics and the legalities are going to be complicated. But we hope that the legislature will help move us down that road.
Thank you very much, Ray. Any questions from the... Thanks again.
Thank you.
excuse me. At this time, we'll go back, I think, on schedule with our agenda. And we have the Healthy Streams Partnership and then the Salmon Recovery Task Force. Tracy Bozen.
He's your constituent. He's your constituent, isn't he?
Yes.
Bringing in all this stuff.
Just a small amount of information.
And for the record, Tracy is from the representative's district, so everybody is requested to be very nice and kind to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today. My name is Tracy Bozen. I'm the coordinator for the Umatilla Basin Watershed Council in Pendleton. I'm also the chair of the Healthy Streams Partnership Committee. And I'm here today to cover a few things that the Healthy Streams Partnership has been working on over the past couple of years. I know that there are a couple of representatives that are new here, and I'll be brief with some background information. The Healthy Streams Partnership was authorized under state statute and is directed to advise the Joint Legislative Committee on Stream Restoration, Species Recovery, and Oregon Plan issues at that time. And I'm not familiar with all of the goings-on here in Salem, so I don't know how those committees have panned out yet, so pardon me for being a little short on information. The Healthy Streams Partnership is charged with providing the committee with information about implementation of the Oregon Plan programs from a regional and local perspective and recommending needed change to facilitate more efficient implementation of Oregon Plan programs at the local level. And basically, the Healthy Streams Partnership is a committee of 21 people, very diverse backgrounds, and they are appointed jointly by the governor, and at the time it was the Joint Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. I'm assuming that it'll be probably the Water Committee will be part of that as the vacancies come open. The partnership, being as diverse as it is, has been... has experienced the obvious committee forming, storming, and norming. And over the past couple of years, we have been able to put together some of our accomplishments, and among those being the diversity of the program itself, and the members has added a distinct flavor to some of the discussions that we've had. We have everything, as far as the committee is concerned, we have folks from both ends of the spectrum, and it's much like an oversized watershed council, a statewide watershed council, if you will, with all of the interests being brought to the table and consulted. Some of the accomplishments that we have endeared ourselves with is support of the 1010 program. As most of you know, that there has been some talk of, in the past legislative sessions, of making changes to the 1010 program. The Healthy Streams Partnership was very supportive of the 1010 program. They were also very supportive of the 401 assumption by the state. I can't remember the House bill number on either one of those, but we were supportive there. And just recently, and I have given you quite a little bit of information here of our past project of the last year, and I want to spend most of my time on that just because it is very timely. You will receive this technical assistance in the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board contacted the Healthy Streams Partnership last year. As most of you probably know, there is a real need for technical assistance to put projects on the ground. Technical assistance meaning anything from engineering to biological assessments to field studies, the whole works that go behind putting good dollars and good projects on the ground. The Healthy Streams Partnership was contacted through OEB because of our connections to the ground statewide. At that time, the Healthy Streams Partnership embarked on an endeavor to pull together the information of what the needs of the technical assistance are statewide. At the time, different Healthy Streams Partnership members met in all five of the OEB geographical areas of the state. There were some 8 to 10 meetings that were held publicly. At that time, we had invited all of the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Watershed Councils, the Farm Bureau, just regular citizens, agency personnel from federal, state, and local agencies to discuss with us what the needs of the technical assistance in their particular areas were. At that time, there was a lot of discussion about the needs, and we had also sent out a questionnaire to 200-plus entities, asking them very specific questions, of which I won't go into detail, but is in this technical assistance guide that I had sent you or had given you. And out of that, we had about a 48% response of the over 200 questionnaires that came out. And some of the information was very informative, and due to the lack of time, I won't go into that. However, as you will look at on page 2 and 3 of the technical assistance guide there, I would like to touch on a couple of the conclusions and recommendations that the Healthy Streams Partnership came with through there. On page 2 in the conclusions, it's important, I think, to recognize at the top there, the technical assistance for restoration projects, planning, and organizational needs is a critical component for successful local implementation of the Oregon Plan. If the Oregon Plan is going to work and the projects are going to be successful and the dollars are going to be there, the technical assistance needs to be there from the beginning. One of the problems that has been experienced is there's a lot of time put into projects ahead of even funding. There's a lot of pre-project work that is done that is unfinanced. A lot of that comes from the watershed councils, a lot of it comes from the Soil and Water Conservation District, and a lot of it comes from the local landowners, even the county agencies. The local folks spend a lot of time on the pre-project work. And it's unfortunate that a lot of times these projects don't get off the ground because of the lack of the technical assistance. A lot of times there are dollars available for these projects, but depending on what area you're in, there is no technical assistance available. As an example, in northeastern Oregon, we have these very small, very remote rural towns that have not even, a population base to them. They have no agency people, personnel. It's very difficult for them to find the technical assistance if it's not already provided through some kind of, most likely, a federal program. Point number 2, some Oregon Plan projects are either not started or completed due to the lack of technical assistance. Farther down, many stakeholder organizations do not have in-house staff to fill the wide range of needed technical expertise. and there's not enough local, state, and federal technical assistance provided to meet demand. Like I say, a lot of times geography has a lot to do with that. Some parts of the state are well organized to help stakeholders find technical assistance. There are parts of the state that do have good technical assistance, and they even have enough to share around that some of the technical assistance can go to other parts. I might add that for the sake of the Salmon organization, simultaneously with us, put together a technical assistance guide for all of the state where a lot of volunteers are brought in who will volunteer their time to develop the technical assistance needs of certain projects. And people statewide can tap into the For the Sake of the Salmon for that information and for the expertise. On page 3, some of the recommendations that the Healthy Streams Partnership has given for technical assistance. I'll cover the important ones. They're all important, but the ones that I highlight, I should say. First one here, maintain current general fund levels for state natural resource agency positions that contribute to technical assistance to Oregon Plan stakeholders. The Healthy Streams Partnership recognizes, obviously, that we are in a budget crisis, and there are a lot of considerations to be made. But our recommendation is that due to the fact that we have already limited technical assistance, that the current level of staffing and funding for those positions would be maintained. Number 2, increase the number of state natural resource agency staff that contribute technical assistance to Oregon Plan stakeholders. Again, we recognize the budget situation. Nevertheless, if there is consideration to be made, hopefully it would be placed in that direction. Number 4, encourage state and federal sources with discretionary grant funds to provide maximum allowable funding for technical assistance at the local level. Everybody needs money. Number 5, coordinate private, public, and nonprofit organization technical assistance funding sources to maximize assistance for projects and planning at the local level. I'd like to bring back that For the Sake of the Salmon program has done a considerable amount of work with this.
Mr. Chairman, please.
Wait, man.
The forestry industry just said they spent $48 million in the last 5 years on projects. Are you all and groups like you working with them, with your technical assistance? Are they doing that by themselves? Is there any coordination? We're looking for resources. That's a lot of money.
So. Representative Schaffler, yes, actually they are working in coordination. There's a lot of cross-pollination, if you will. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are some entities or groups who would rather work with one over the other, and you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's a matter of personalities most of the time.
I understand.
But yes, there is a lot of crossover there.
Good. Thank you.
Number 6.
We'll give you a few more minutes, Tracy, but we are running short on the timeline, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know you're going as fast as you can.
Develop incentives to support pre-project, post-project technical assistance. I already covered that. Consider opportunities where appropriate to amend statutes and or administrative rules to move revenues received from natural resources agencies, civil penalties, or fines to a fund that addresses local technical assistance needs. There's been a lot of talk about local individuals or organizations who have been fined for Clean Water Act violations or some of those kind of things. We're hoping that maybe some of those funds, those fine funds, could be moved into a technical assistance sort of situation where we can move those funds over there and put them to use in that direction. Last one that I'll cover is number 9, utilize existing local infrastructure to deliver technical assistance to the maximum extent possible. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to utilize the existing infrastructures of the soil and water conservation districts, the watershed councils, or the entities that already house the technical assistance that is available. And if it's a situation where there is no technical assistance, the watershed councils, the soil and water conservation district would be happy to house these individuals or the assistance that's needed. In closing, I would like to mention that, again, the Healthy Streams Partnership is a committee of very diverse people. I mentioned earlier that it's like a statewide watershed council, and it's effective because of the diversity of opinions and the expertise that the folks have on there. Hopefully in the year to come, the Healthy Streams Partnership is looking forward to being able to be more what they were designed for as far as being the eyes and the ears to the governor and to the committees involved so that we can tell you what works and what doesn't work as far as projects and the implementation and funding of the projects on the ground.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for Tracy this morning?
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, we have the Salmon Recovery Task Force. Bob Jacobson was chair, and Ed Bowles is here to offer him his assistance this morning. Ed Bowles with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Fish Division. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Jensen and committee members, good morning, and Bob, welcome back.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Bob Jacobson. I reside at 2225 Northwest Ocean View Drive in Newport. I was one of 13 members of the Salmon Recovery Task Force created by the 2001 Legislative Assembly as a result of House Bill 3002. It was also my privilege to have chaired that group. I'm going to provide you today with a very brief overview of the committee, its activities, and its conclusions. Three of the 13 committee members are with us today, your own Representative Jensen and Representative Dingfelder. Greg probably left, but he was also a member of that committee representing the Department of Agriculture. In addition, the task force was extremely fortunate to have the services of members of the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, acronym IMST, available to us, particularly its co-chair, Stan Gregory. His advice and input were invaluable through the process. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that term, the IMST group was a group appointed by the 1997 legislative session to assist with science issues as it related to the Oregon Plan. Primarily a group of OSU professors from different disciplines. Finally, Ed Bowles, ODFW Chief of Fisheries, who's sitting alongside me here, provided invaluable input and advice, even though he wasn't a member of the committee. And Ed's here today to answer any questions you might have as a result of our actions or as a result of my testimony. Section 18 of House Bill 3002 directed the task force to, number one, define recovery. Number two, develop and coordinate a scientific workshop with IMST. Number three, establish criteria for evaluation of salmon recovery. And number four, develop legislation for recommendation to the 72nd legislative session. And I think you all have in front of you our final report, and you'll see those four tasks listed in there. And I think there's also a copy of House Bill 3002 from last session. The full task force met five times during 2002. In addition, the chair appointed several subcommittees of the group, which met periodically. Our meetings were open to the public, and their comments were invited and solicited. Defining the word recovery might seem to some to be a relatively simple task. I will be the first to concede that I initially underestimated the difficulty of that assignment. Virtually all of our meeting time was directed towards that issue, as was a portion of the 1.5-day workshop we held on salmon recovery, where many of the best scientific minds in the region were present. It wasn't until the last hour of the final meeting that we were able to come up with a definition that all task force members could agree on. That definition can be found on page 2 of the final report. Our second assignment was to develop and coordinate a meeting on salmon recovery with IMST. That 1.5-day meeting was held on June 1st and 2nd in Corvallis, and as I mentioned above, was attended by over 30 of the top scientists in this region. The proceedings of that meeting provided an enlightening insight into the thinking of many of the key players involved in salmon recovery in the regions, and I know I felt it was very worthwhile being there. Representative Jensen was there for the full session. I just thought it was a wonderful education for someone who wasn't really up to speed on salmon recovery issues. An abbreviated summary of the workshop considerations and findings are included as Appendix B in your final report. Our third charge under HB 3002 was to establish criteria for evaluation of salmon recovery. The task force, however, simply had neither the time nor the resources to complete the work necessary to make those recommendations. Several technical processes are currently underway to complete the task and are described in the report. The need for such criteria remains critically important, and the task force urges continued progress towards that end. Finally, our last task was to prepare legislation. House Bill 2138 is included in your packet, and that's the legislation that has resulted from our work. Finally, I'd like to thank Sandy Teely Circa for all her help. She was our staff assistant during the interim. Without her, we simply wouldn't have completed the task at hand. So thank you. If there are any questions, either I or Ed will try to answer them.
Yes. Any questions? Representative Cruz.
Sorry, I had to step out for a minute, Mr. Chair, but going to the bill itself, listed unit, I mean, we're still kind of hooked into this. Are we still kind of hooked into this kind of matrix that the National Marine Fisheries Service put in, environmentally, what did they call that? I'm having a senior moment here, and that's really disturbing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, the evolutionary significant unit.
Yes, yes. I'm wondering if we are still kind of hooked into that with all of the new data we have over the meanderings of these fish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, both the Fish and Wildlife Service, my name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Excuse me. We are still using the construct that the federal government has for drawing circles around these populations of fish, consistent with their approach. The task force, the workshop, and the definition doesn't really take that on per se. So you do have different geographic circles drawn on a map, basically, that bring certain populations together into a group. And those are referred to by as distinct population segments by Fish and Wildlife Service for like bull trout and others, and for salmon and steelhead, most of it is ESUs, as you mentioned, Representative.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is that we're putting into statute a definition that that I'm not sure is necessarily where we should be going, because we know, for example, that these fish do meander, and we're kind of saying these fish have to be here when they're not necessarily there. I would rather be able to look at the Oregon coast and the Oregon watershed system as a whole unit, rather than part of it being hooked to California and part of it being hooked to Washington, sort of thing. I guess just one of the concerns I'm going to have with this bill when we get there, assuming it comes here.
I think it is here. And did you want to comment in?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, just one of the directions that State of Oregon has been taking, as well as moving the federal agencies in this direction, is trying to move away a little bit from a one-size-fits-all standards and criteria. We're finding that those don't always fit to local watershed needs. And so by using these smaller groupings of populations as opposed to full statewide single designations, it allows us to custom tailor not only the recovery criteria, but some of those measures that we'll take to meet recovery, allows us to custom tailor those to the local watershed needs as opposed to just a statewide. And so that's part of the reason for having these smaller groupings of populations as opposed to just a statewide designation.
Thank you. Other?
Just one more comment on that. I guess one of the frustrations the last few years has been the ES U that has connected Southern Oregon to California. And clearly the California runs have been in worse shape than the Oregon runs, and so we have had some relatively healthy runs kind of trapped into the same construct as runs in another state that we have no jurisdiction over. So you can see my frustration with, you say you don't want to do one size fits all, but you've done one size fits all in a smaller box.
Maybe better a smaller box than.
Well, if you want to, if you don't want to have one size fits all, Mr. Chair, I'd say you do it watershed by watershed.
And I think there was considerable discussion on that, especially we got into the Columbia River and the salmon in the Columbia River. Other questions? We will be, this bill will be one of our first significant bills that we'll be hearing in the committee. We want to be taking some action on it, and we will look forward, Bob and Ed, to your being back to guide us a little bit through the bill as we get to that point. I just want to editorialize a little bit and compliment Bob for the hard work that he did. I believe he was really honest and truthful with you when he said he didn't realize how difficult a project he had undertaken. And I think there were times that he wished that he had said no when it came to the...
Throw up my hands and walk out. Not quite, but...
And I know that that he put numerous hours outside of the actual committee work, doing research study, talking to people, getting information on his own to be able to help that task force through there. So I'd like to thank you for the hard work that you did with that. And we'll look forward to hearing this bill very shortly in this committee.
Appreciate your comments, and we'll be back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on, the implementing organizations, Soil and Water Conservation Districts. John McDonald, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me to participate with you this morning. And Chair Jensen, we're very, very pleased to see that you have returned. My name is John McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I'm also a District Director in the Washington County Soil Water Conservation District. Have been a member of the Tualatin River Watershed Council for 6 years and was chair 2 years of that time. I have passed out a certain number of little handout things that are kind of a guide to the presentation I want to make this morning, also because I know that I'm not going to have time to say all that I have here, so it's sort of written down if you choose to look at it on your own. The first page is kind of a little schematic that shows two things. One is Soil and Water Conservation Districts have been around a long time. We've been here since 1940, when the first one was formed, and the last one was formed in 1972. 35 and have consolidated into 15, so we've arrived at 45 current districts from an original listing of 65. Just a little note that, you know, sometimes when organizations start out, they do consolidate, they do gather and start looking at larger areas. The one thing that it does not show here, which I'd like to take credit for, is that a whole lot was done during these years, long before the Oregon Plan came around, long before we had any of the current programs and stuff like that. Districts have been out there doing stuff. One of the bad things about their record is they didn't spend a lot of time writing down records, and they didn't spend a lot of time talking about it, so it was always a very well-kept secret. It was primarily a way of linking the federal resources through the Department of Agriculture to the local landowners, and conservation districts were that link in the sense that we helped with the technical assistance and we helped keep the offices open, and we were the ones that actually approved the plans that were originally funded by federal and state sources to do that thing. So this is just a little schematic to indicate that, you know, these are the 45 conservation districts we're talking about. On the next page, under governance and structure, I tried to list a number of the things that we do operate as. We are a local government. We are a subdivision of state government, and I'm still waiting for somebody to explain exactly what that means. For audit purposes, we are a city. a municipality, so sometimes it's a little confusing. We do have an enabling statute, ORS 568, and that gives us a number of things that govern what districts are and what we can do, and I'll point to those in a few minutes. We do have a wind erosion control program, and we also have the item number three there, the Agriculture Water Quality Management Program, which was alluded to earlier by the Department of Agriculture representatives, also known as SB 1010. Other couple statutes that are in other places in other laws, we do have the authority to be a taxing district, and frankly, I think that's the future of conservation districts down the road. There are three currently now that have that taxing authority, a permanent tax rate, and others will be trying, and that, frankly, I think is the way to go down the road. We do have the authority to be the local management agencies as defined by statute. Item number C indicates that we do have the power to make intergovernmental agreements, and that's quite important because there are a number of provisions, statutes, that say that monies can be given to districts to make grants to others, to landowners in cost-share programs, to other agencies, whatever it may be, that we could actually be a granting operation in that sense. We do have requirements in the state statutes, again, that require that we have a long-range plan, an annual work plan, that we do a financial audit, and so we're trying to do a lot of things in order to beef up the accountability and the response to some public interest. Under 5 and 6, down there, we also have to follow the things that operate as special districts. So there's a set of guidelines that have to be followed that fit all special districts. And, of course, as a public body, we, of course, adhere to the statutes about public contracting, public meetings, et cetera, et cetera. Turning over that page, we indicate that there's some information about the directors. There's 291 of us. We are elected for four-year terms in the November general election. Each district has either seven or five, depending on the original choice that they made. Two of those are always at-large positions, elected by the general population of the district, and three of them are also elected by the general population, but to represent geographical zones. 29 districts represent their whole county. Six of them are split into two, and Baker County has four districts, which is kind of an anomaly. Our staffing, we have 155 individuals that constitute 114 FTE, and 14 of those are Watershed Council coordinators that are under the employment of the district. Our offices, of course, are usually in the agricultural service centers. The next page, you can see a little chart that shows the Conservation District directors and employees for 2002, how many of each. We also have associate directors and directors emeritus, and the only way you get on those two lists is you actually have to be actively involved in the program. It isn't 50 years ago you served as a director, but we haven't seen you in 25 years. You would not be on this list. It means people are still working away at the program. The next couple pages point out the major 16 powers and authorities of conservation districts.
Mr. Chair, may I ask you a question?
Tell me.
Yes, thank you. I'm looking for Multnomah County on the number of districts, and I don't see any.
There's a West Multnomah and East Multnomah.
Thank you.
You have the pleasure of two, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representing to me.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Under powers and authorities, there are a few that are critical. Of course, the first one, securing surveys, investigations, doing research, that's the critical part of finding out what are the problems, which we call resource concerns, as we try to identify the issues that need to be addressed, the issues on the land, and the issues particularly affecting agricultural producers. There's also an item three, carry out preventive and control measures. That's a very, very broad thing that says we can pretty much do what needs to be done once we've identified what that is. Four, we can enter into written agreements, and that is often done with both state, federal, local, and tribal contracts and so forth. We can acquire property, borrow money. We can make available to landowners a number of pieces of equipment or supplies or materials in order to do plantings and so forth. Some of the districts are doing an excellent job of actually finding ways to purchase no-till drills and so forth and then rent them back to landowners because they're kind of expensive for a person to operate if they don't have the size operation to afford one. And there's a number of others, such as number nine, comprehensive plans and specifications that fit with, obviously, with the SB 1010 plans as well as the regular plans that we turn in, the long-range plans. The most important things I want to mention very quickly are the customary functions of Oregon Conservation Districts on the next page. It is very, very important that we exercise that first authority to coordinate processes to involve citizens and stakeholders in assessments, surveys, and long-range planning. Obviously, the effort is to determine what are the problems, what are the desired conditions, and what are the strategies to try to bring the things closer to what we want them to be. Often the first thing we ask of a landowner group is, what do you want your stream to look like? What do you want your land to look like? What do you want your uplands to look like? And then how do we get there? The second item of developing long-range plans and business plans is a very comprehensive process we're currently undertaking with all the districts of identifying, again, what are those concerns, what are those strategies, how are they going to manage it, how are they going to find the resources, and an actual strategic plan as well as a business plan that fits not only resource concerns but also district operations. And, of course, we do implement the actual work and your work plans. The big item you've heard today is item four. And that is technical assistance. We do site visits, consultations, conservation plan development, oversight in installing conservation practices. The first three are the critical ones: marketing, research, planning, monitoring, and so forth. And that's the thing you're probably going to hear this entire session is, how do we get that done? These are practices that landowners cannot do themselves. I'm a fairly knowledgeable landowner, and I started out to do some things on my own property. I couldn't do it. I had to go get a specialist to actually do some engineering to figure out how to do it right. And even then, I have to make some repairs on it after 5 years when the floods come and it washes away. But these are the kinds of things that are needed, and also critical are the function of districts in order to be able to use the federal funds. Because it's almost like we are the conduit to both point out where those funds ought to be spent, on what problems they ought to be spent, and then approve the plans to actually authorize the landowners to receive the cost share funds. Individual landowner conservation plans we review, serve as local management agencies, and you can see the others. Item E is the one down at the bottom I was just referring to, where we actually chair and convene the local working groups, which are groups of a lot of different people, primarily from state and federal agencies, because that's by law what they have to be. And so we go on from there. On the next page, funding. Oregon Department of Agriculture gives $8,000 for administrative functions, and you can see what those pay for. Each district gets between $5,000 and $10,000 as the local management agency for SB 1010 work. And then on item three, we have been distributing $2.4 million that has come to technical assistance. That's giving each district approximately 34.4, excuse me, each county. And then the districts that have split, counties that have split districts, obviously have to also split that amount of money. And there's some other varieties there. Next page, we have a series of things that we do with the Conservation Partnership. That's primarily the Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, RCs and Ds, which some of you may or may not know about, Resource Development and Resource Conservation and Development Councils, and, of course, the OSU Extension that we use extensively for both landowner contacts and education. And identify some of the partnerships there. The next page, which I'm referring to as measures of accountability and raising the bar, are things we're doing right now to increase the capacity of districts to handle both the workload, the increasing technicality of some of the work that has to be done, and the accountability that people are asking of them. There's a number of things here that we've done. Grant program and reporting structure has been totally revised, where there's actually some teeth in it. A district can lose its funds if it doesn't do certain things, or at least have those funds delayed if they're not, in a sense, going along to the guidelines. We're capitalizing on the opportunities in the USDA Farm Bill, of course, by looking at every single opportunity to take advantage of that. We have just finished with ODA an evaluation of the CREP program, looking extensively at what we can do to increase sign-ups of landowners to take advantage of the federal money that is there, because this is one of the Farm Bill programs that is unique. It is a state-federal partnership in a way that the others are not, where the state has a significant investment both through its own funds as well as through assistance with the Department of Forestry. Other things that we're doing, we're actually putting in a new accounting system right now. In fact, it starts this afternoon in Beaverton at 1 o'clock, the first training program. It will also be available to watershed councils who desire to have that shifting over to a a standard chart of accounts and a formatting of reporting to both OWEB and ODA. Self-assessment, local tax approval, of course, we're seeking. The long-range business plan is becoming a lot more than what it used to be as far as a couple pages of stuff thrown together about what we think the problems are and so forth. Highly, highly upgraded. We've just completed a major process of training and development of the Soil and Water Conservation Guidebook. And now we have a series of updates, and that's this little thing here, which actually is all the stuff it takes for districts to be able to, quote, run the operation and, most importantly, stay legal. We're working, as you've heard before, with the Endangered Species Act and 4D rule, trying to work how we can come up with models of how some of that authority and decision-making can be transferred to the local decision-makers. Of course, the animal CAFL, AFL-CAFL program is getting underway with new rules. We're into the process of easements, of course, and looking at the possibility of districts being holders of easements in addition to being co-holders. And one thing that's not on that list that I probably should have said is a major thing is the entire reporting structure. We do not yet have a good structure to report all that we've been doing. And I've read the guidelines and I've read the annual reports and the annual work plans, and it is fabulous. It's enormous, the amount of work that is done. And I really feel sorry that I don't have a quick way to tell you, because we haven't developed the system yet. It's in process, but it's not here yet to tell you exactly what's happening. The last thing are just some selected little success stories that I hope that you will look at, of little things of people have done in response to, for example, the forest fires last summer, or coming up with a drip irrigation system that's run by solar power, and the no-tilling and weed management. Like Sherman County has spent, since 1990, over $1 million implementing programs on 73,000 acres. Well, there's some striking things here, and I think it's something that the conservation districts have every right to be very proud of. We think we're making a significant contribution by what we do to the Oregon Plan, and we obviously earnestly solicit your continued support. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the thoroughness and still quickness with which you went through this material. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question of John.
Quick.
Mm-hmm. Good to see you again, John. In your CREP evaluation, I introduced a bill last session that was passed into law that allows a landowner who's farming, as I do, next to streams, from the stream inward to 35 feet, to be able to make a decision to take that riparian area along that stream out of production of whatever intensified agricultural production there might be there, and receive a tax credit for a portion of whatever they would have received off of that in terms of profit. Mm-hmm. When you do your CREP evaluation, could you look to see if that's in harmony with your current procedures in terms of CREP, and maybe at some later point when you've done your CREP evaluation, you could come back to us and report to us how well that's worked? Because if it hasn't, I'd like to know if there are any impediments of us being able to marry the two programs together and integrate them. Because I understand CREP starts at 35 feet, and so we're trying to just fill that gap in there. So when you have an opportunity to do that, that'd be great.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Representative Krupp, I'd be very happy to take that out and take a look at it. One of the things we did in this study was a little bit different. Talk about not having one size fit all. We went county by county and identified the specific barriers that landowners were facing, including the size of the riparian zone and other factors, the width that would be acceptable. Some of them wanted to put in like whole acreages or whole plots and so forth, when the riparian area essentially made a particular plot unfarmable or uneconomical. We identified 18 different barriers and then attached those barriers to highest priority and second priority and indeed third priority, county by county. What needed to be done first? What needed to be done second? And if you solve those two, you might have to do the third one, because all of a sudden it becomes a barrier. But the issue of tax credits was not addressed in that study, and we will take a look at it, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder.
I just have a quick follow-up, and good to see you, John. John used to be my employer and my boss, so I'm always nice to John. But, John, I have a quick question regarding looking at other states, because I used to do a lot of work with Washington, and they have a very successful CREP program there, and I was always perplexed as to why we were having some challenges with ours. So have you talked to the folks in Washington State? And if... I'd be curious to see what...
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, it's difficult still to call you that, ma'am. But since we've called each other several things over the years.
It's not easy for us either, but we do it.
I used to say that I taught her everything I know, and then I said, I'm sorry. What was your question, ma'am?
About Washington's CREP program, yes. And doing a comparison.
We actually looked at five different states, Minnesota, North Carolina, Illinois, Washington, and so forth. And the interesting thing is the statistics do not bear up what you say. Mm. They have not been more successful. They started out much faster than we did. We started out very slowly. We actually began to pick up a little bit of momentum over the last year or so. And in relationship to, and this is the only way I can look at it, if you take into account how much money they spent versus how much production they got compared to the money we spent and the production we got, we actually did better than Washington. But yes, we did look at all the major other states that had CREP programs and found some major, major differences. And we've made those into our recommendations, particularly the idea of what is the primary eligibility factor. Here it is fish-bearing streams. In all the other states, it was water quality. Mm. Nobody else limited it by fish-bearing streams, and therefore they had other places that qualified that we actually disqualified because of that particular barrier. And there were a number of other things as to how they did it. They have also, across the board, put in much, much more state investment than we have.
The chair is very interested in this CREP program and what we have and haven't done with it. We've talked quite a bit about it over the last two sessions with various groups. I think we'll plan to... have a specific session or part of a day set aside to look at the CREP program. And one of my motivations for doing so is that we have in the past been criticized rather heavily by the federal agencies for non-participation. And they have used that as something of a justification for what some of us felt like was the guillotine for enforcement of some other areas. So I really would like to have a look at that, and I assume that you'll probably be back with us at that time, if you can, John, when we look at the CREP program.
Mr. Chair, I'd be very happy to do so, and I think it is also it bears study because it has some characteristics to it that other programs don't necessarily do, and that it is a very close mandated relationship between federal, state, and local people putting the program together in cooperation with landowners, and I think that in itself is worth study. Thank you.
And colleagues, we're going to cut this off for John because we are going to run out of time here, and I don't want to deprive anyone of time, so thank you very much.
Chair Jensen, do I get to ask for special favor if I was born in Pendleton and graduated from Pendleton High School? Does that help any?
That helps a lot.
Great.
That helps a lot. Okay, we're on to Watershed Councils, and Tracy Bozen back with us, along with Renee Ferris, the treasurer of the Mid-Columbia Watershed Council and Lincoln County Soil and Water Conservation District. And as I indicated, gentlemen, we are pushing our envelope of time. Would appreciate
brevity,
if possible.
Mr. Chair, committee, it's quite a pleasure to come here today. I'm here totally, completely as a volunteer. I'm a small business person on the coast, very small business person. Economy downfall has not treated me well, but I believe so strongly in the Oregon plan and what we're doing that it's a pleasure to come here. One correction, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, it's the Mid-Coast Watershed Councils, which is Cascade Head to south end of the county, 10 mile. I got involved in watershed councils 5 years ago, primarily as seeing myself as a representative of people that are maybe contrary to what I had described as environmentalists. And after working with the council and the conservation district for a relatively short while, found out that I am one. And the diversity of the group.
Mr. Ferris, for the record, could you give us your name?
I'm very sorry. Rennie Ferris. I'm, as I said, treasurer of the Mid-Coast. I'm also treasurer of the Lincoln Soil and Water Conservation District and owner of Ferris Landscaping.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry for the interruption.
Yeah, it's my fault. Yeah, sorry. Found it kind of interesting. One person that was on the council that I felt I would be most in conflict with was a lady by the name of Fran Recht. Most of you probably heard about her. She's a very distinguished activist, and it turns out that if there's a minority opinion in council decisions, it's most likely going to be Fran Recht and I that will be in agreement in that minority. It was she's become a good friend. I firmly believe in the Oregon Plan. I've seen it work. We have processes that we've put in place. The strength of diversity is shown over and over again. Go through the technical processes, just like what was mentioned earlier by Ray, assessments, prioritizations, try and direct our work where it's going to do the most good. And what we're feeling most important is that we get back and look at what we've done to make sure it is doing what we want it to do. And one of the biggest problems we've had is riparian planning, trying to address that, find ways to make that successful. Most of the other things that we're doing, we find work very, very well. You can see it in a hurry. If you replace a fish passage barrier, if you fix that, you're going to see fish move where they weren't moving before. Some of the planting things has been more challenging. But my where the niche I've felt that I fit best in the council is on the physical side of things, the administrative committee. It's the junk that nobody likes to deal with. You probably all are feel the same way about a lot of the kinds of things, but it's kind of a job that not very many other people want to do. It's been great for the council in that we can take the issues of insurance and writing up changes to bylaws and so on, get that all dealt with in a committee. And when we come to the council, not having to have these long drawn out sessions when we're trying to pull people from the far distances that what we pull them from to make that work. One of the other strengths of the council has been an inclusion and actually a decided effort that resulted in four basin teams so that the major streams in our council have their own sub-basin group that has a much easier time of pulling people from one end of a stream to the other, get them together in their area rather than trying to get people from up the Salmon River in behind Lincoln City or practically in Corvallis, the upper reaches of the ALC. But they can bring them to their meetings in the ALC, the Siletz and the Aquinnah. That works very, very well. The people on the admin committee have really strived to try and make our processes as fair and open to everybody. It's resulted in most of the work is still done by local people, but the process is open and above board. We feel that anybody at any time could come into the office and ask to see anything regarding decisions on any grants or whatever, that the rationale is going to be there, the rules are there, that's fair and above board to everybody. And
We've got about five more minutes.
Well, I'm not going to need five more minutes.
Okay.
Because I think the success of our efforts, work on my part and Fran's and a few others, are summed up. This is an audit review, last year's audit review with the Watershed Council, and the final paragraph, very short. Based on our review, we are not aware of any material modifications that should be made to the accompanying financial statements in order for them to be in conformity with general accepted accounting principles. I am very proud of that.
Thank you. Tracy.
Mr. Chair and representatives, very quickly, and again,
for
I'll be brief.
Again.
A little bit of background information on Watershed Council.
Tracy, for the record again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Tracy Bozen, the coordinator. I'm switching hats, actually, from the previous. I'm no longer speaking for the Healthy Streams Partnership. I'm Tracy Bozen, coordinator of the Umatilla Basin Watershed Council based in Pendleton. In 1994, House Bill 2246, I believe, enabled watershed councils to be formed throughout the state. And from that, obviously most of you know about watershed councils and the work that they do has been very tremendous. Currently, Measure $66 and the salmon plate dollars, there's also a lot of federal funds that are leveraged, and those are the monies that are funneled into watershed councils for support and for projects through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Watershed councils receive their funding through a grant process that is competitive and merit-based. And these are new rules that have been put into place, so watershed councils are provided funds through their good works, basically are taken into consideration. It is merit-based, and it's not just money that is randomly provided to each council. Some of the accomplishments in our particular area of the Umatilla in northeastern Oregon has been, as an example, the Walla Walla Watershed Council just recently signed an agreement with several of the irrigation districts, and last year was the first year in over 100 years that the Walla Walla River has actually had free running water year-round. It had been dewatered prior to that. In our own basin, the Umatilla Basin, we have what we call the Umatilla Basin Project. We had the same situation where the Umatilla River was dewatered for long extended periods of time over the summer. We now pump water out of the Columbia River up over a hill into the irrigation districts who are using the water from the river itself. We've exchanged that so that now they are using the Columbia River water to irrigate, and the Umatilla River water stays in stream. And this has also enabled the fisheries to return. In fact, we have an outstanding record with the recovery of the salmon. Actually, we had extinct species and they have been reintroduced. We're currently involved with sub-basin planning through Bonneville Power Administration. Most of you have probably heard about the dollars that are available through Bonneville Power Administration. They're now requiring that each sub-basin to the Columbia River come up with a sub-basin plan. That has been a very difficult task to perform, and the watershed councils in most of the areas have been taking on the chair of this particular programs so that all the representative interests, all the interests could be represented in the development of the planning. And from that, Bonneville Power will use those plans to determine where they're going to place their project dollars for salmon restoration.
Mr. Chairman, may I please?
Representative.
Back to the Umatilla recovery. Would you consider that population, what's called in somewhere in here, a sustainable population now?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schaffler, yes, it is. We do have hatcheries on the river, and we're supplementing those, but the return last year was almost 80,000.
Wow. Thank you.
And that's just in the Umatilla.
Mm-hmm.
We also have another project called the Butter Creek Project in our area that's over 100,000 contiguous acres that OEB has funded for rehabilitation. It includes erosion practices, includes vegetation, off-site watering where grazing had occurred on the creek bed, and it's been moved up the hill so that they no longer have access. A lot of fencing, a lot of miles of fencing have been put in. And I guess part of this, the focus of what I'd like to say today is these projects get on the ground through the Watershed Council and through the Soil and Water Conservation District because of the trust that the people have for these organizations. The Watershed Council and the SWCD folks are local individuals. They have a vested interest in the land. The Watershed Councils in particular are volunteers who are people who donate their time and their expertise to be able to do good things for their communities. They're very trusted. And that's part of what makes it work. And one of the concerns that we have is that, of course, our funding comes through Measure 66 and it's funneled through OWEB. And we have really pounded the ground with folks because they're very, the landowners, they're very leery of government programs, government projects, those things that are financed by the government, whether it be federal or state, because they, you know, out where we live, people have a kind of a rough background sometimes, and don't like those government folks. And we've really pounded the ground selling the whole idea of watershed councils and the funding through OWEB, because OWEB obviously is a non-regulatory agency. And our concern is that we have an interest in OWEB, a vested interest in OWEB, and we know that there are competing bills out there to basically gut OWEB or to distribute it, diminish its value, what we feel, because it's an agency that people trust, and it's where the funding comes through. And In closing, Chairman Jensen, I just want to state that watershed councils work, and the reason why they work is because they're trusted. And OWEB and the state has, through all of the programs, has enabled the watershed councils to work in an effective way. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate your coming all the way over to Salem. We appreciate the work that you're doing for us. You had a quick question or comment.
Could I have one of my minutes back, Mr. Chair?
Forgot
to mention the annual report. Did those get passed out for the...
Yes.
Okay. I hope that you take a look at that, give you an idea of the types of projects. There's some huge scale difference there in what we're doing. So appreciate that. Also, the interest in noxious weeds, it is a scary one. So I hope you keep that up.
On page 5, yeah, the picture of the noxious weeds.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
At this point, we have the Oregon Trout, Audrey Russell, the Associate Director of Law and Policy, and I believe he's being joined also with the Executive Director, Joe Whitworth. Gentlemen, I don't mean in any way to cut you short, but we'd like to try to get all of our agenda covered today, so if you could, what brevity you can come up with, we would appreciate it.
Thank you. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Joe Whitworth. I am Executive Director of Oregon Trout. With me is Aubrey Russell, our Legislative Director. Together we hope to give you some sense of the work that Oregon Trout has done with regard to the Oregon Plan, and a good sense for what we hope to continue to do with the Oregon Plan. I generally don't get down to Salem too much in my position, and this is one of those subjects that is so central to the work that we do and to the future of this state that it certainly merits my time and the drive down here. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. By way of introduction to some of the newer members of the committee, Oregon Trout is a not-for-profit 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, whose mission is to protect and restore wild fish, native fish, and the ecosystems upon which they depend. Begun in 1983, we are the oldest wild fish conservation group in the Pacific Northwest, and we have about 1,000 current members on our rolls, dues-paying members on our rolls, with probably twice that that we maintain contact with, some of which are sitting on the committee today with our newsletters. We have really three moving parts to the work that we do: our education program, on-the-ground restoration, and our policy work. Though some of you probably are most familiar with the policy work that we do, a couple of key pieces that we do and do have implications for the Oregon Plan revolve around education and restoration. We are one of the original watershed educators, and we run we have a science curriculum that is tied directly to state science benchmarks that we provide to schools throughout the state, and we have a culminating experience in the field with students in counties throughout Oregon. Right now we're running about 4,000 Oregon youth through that program each fall. We have just, in terms of restoration, it ranges from tree plantings by our students to large channel renovations. We have just received word that the International Erosion Control Association will be granting us its most prestigious award later this month, for the work that we've done in the lower Wood River down in the Klamath Basin. And that work involves tribes, landowners, corporations, federal agencies, state agencies, really across the board. And that is the type of work that can occur with and in conjunction with the Oregon Plan. Now, ultimately, our intent is to have each part of our work complement the others. And the end game is to get at recovery. Ray Wilkerson mentioned earlier that the Endangered Species Act can stop you from cutting a tree, but it can't tell you to plant one. And that is truly a key point to the Oregon Plan. The Endangered Species Act is simply it's an emergency brake. And the Oregon Plan can actually get us to move toward recovery. And that is exactly how we've started to use the Oregon Plan in its beginning stages. Now, we have been a steadfast supporter of the Oregon Plan for exactly that reason. We don't want to litigate to get to protecting our resources. And I don't think many people in Oregon want to do that either. So we, dating all the way back to before the 1999 executive order, we were involved in the origins of the Healthy Stream Partnership that laid the foundation for the plan. My predecessor at Oregon Trout was the chief petitioner for Measure 66, which provides the funding for OWEB and all the watershed councils and the work that's done on the ground today. And that was a dramatic increase of funding because GWEB, the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, was the precursor to OWEB, and they could only between $1 and $4 million a year for watershed restoration. Now we're doing somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 million a year, and we have only begun to scratch the surface, so to speak, with that money. The genius of the Oregon Plan is that it recognizes human nature as well as biological and economic realities. More than half of all threatened coho habitat exists on private lands. So you can't ignore private land and say we can make everything peachy on public lands and we've got our problem whipped. Before the Oregon Plan came along, the private landowner didn't have quite enough incentive to undertake projects prior to litigation, and he had no recourse afterwards. And the Oregon Plan has changed that. Certainly it's begun to change that, and over time it will change that even more radically. Everybody in Oregon wants to take care of its streams, but paying the bills sometimes gets in the way of undertaking those restoration projects. By tapping into private landowners' self-interest in their own local watershed and removing, to some extent, the incentive barriers, the Oregon Plan is truly moving us forward to recovery. And I agree with Bob Jacobson, recovery is, though it's a relatively short word, it is a very difficult thing to define. For our part, we have pushed forward the Oregon Plan at every turn. We have been on advisory committees ranging from the Forest Practices Act, Forest Practices Act Advisory Committee. We've been on the Eastside Riparian Function Advisory Committee. We have served with stakeholders like the Farm Bureau and OFIC to provide technical assistance in land acquisition rules for OWEB. We participated in Senate Bill 1010 local advisory committees with Bob Jacobson, whom you heard from earlier about the Salmon Recovery Task Force. We were appointed to and served on that committee with him and the other 12 members. We are currently sitting on the Oregon Plan Outreach Team, and as it happens, we are sitting now as the chair of that committee. It's rotating, and we're hoping to get some more well, some more funding to make sure that the that all Oregonians understand what how they can kind of plug into the Oregon plan. Not everybody, even though I'm one of the minority percentage in the world who walks around every day thinking about fish, typical Oregonians don't really do that. We have engaged in a lot of on-the-ground restoration, primarily through private money that we have received through donations and volunteers and membership dues. We actually haven't really put to work any OWEB funding, but we have worked with watershed councils and SWCDs to put things down on the ground. And that goes from the Rogue River all the way out to the John Day country. And while much of the work that, well, much work has been done. A lot of the statistics that were cited last week, Jeff Huntington and the stream miles and so forth, is a great, great start. There still remains a lot of work out there. And really, this is where the Oregon Plan's biggest strength is. We're out of the gates, relatively speaking, pretty fast, but really, it's the future that is going to matter for this plan. And one of the big things that I would like to leave you with today is that Oregon Trout stands ready to work with all stakeholders to move this process forward, because the conversations that we are having in 2003 weren't happening in 1997, and without the Oregon Plan they still wouldn't be happening today. And that is a key point for Oregon to take control of its own future. Now, you've heard a number of people present testimony over the last week or so about the 4D plan. And there, I don't want to misspeak here. It is a fairly complex issue. It is a legal point. But essentially, the Endangered Species Act has within its body language that says, look, if a state comes up with a game plan for recovery that is active and adequate, they can get the get-out-of-jail card free of the Endangered Species Act. That's kind of a rough picture of that. The difficulty is the Federal Endangered Species Act is the backstop of all these, you know, of the imperiled species. To the extent that we move forward and try to gain exemption from that backstop, we're fiddling with the backstop. And the act set out in 1973, if you read the legislative history, sets out that is a very high bar to meet, and rightfully so. And while Oregon Trout conceptually supports Oregon and all the stakeholders with the Oregon Plan moving forward to gain exemption from the Federal Endangered Species Act, I want to say that is a huge undertaking. And again, Oregon Trout stands ready to work with all stakeholders to move that forward, because it matters for the state of Oregon and to a bunch of fish in trouble. With that, I would try to answer any questions you may have. Or you can kick me out of here in the interest of time.
In the interest of time. Thank you very much for here. We appreciate your coming here, appreciate your testimony, and appreciate working with you. Look forward to having a good working relationship this time.
Chair Jensen, I really didn't expect you to take me up on that offer.
Thank you. And at this point, we have Gene Underhill-Wilkerson with the Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Hi, Gene.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, I'm Jean Underhill-Wilkinson, Associate Director for Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will make my testimony very short. Most of you know who I am and what our organization is.
Jean.
Yes.
We will certainly extend the courtesy to run over a few minutes for you. So if you have, you don't
Thank you.
Have
Appreciate
to,
that.
We'll be glad to give you 5 minutes more.
Thank you. I don't think I'll need it, but thank you very much.
Okay.
The Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, of course, represents about 10,000 farm families and ranch families across the state. We've been in existence for many, many years and are the largest agriculture organization in the state. And we've been involved with elements of the Oregon Plan since its inception. We were involved with the Health and Streams Partnership. In fact, Pete Test sat on the Healthy Streams Partnership representing the Farm Bureau for many years. And we've been involved with Senate Bill 1010 planning. We were actively involved in drafting the bill when it was passed, assisted in the passage of that bill, and have been very active in giving assistance to landowners across the state in their involvement in the local advisory committees that put those Senate Bill 1010 plans on the ground and draft those plans on the local watershed level and implement those. Of course, there can always be some improvements made in various elements of the Oregon Plan as scientific information becomes more available and as technological advances become available. A particular interest to the Farm Bureau members at this time is finding ways to minimize environmental liabilities associated with increasing growth of environmental regulations on this national level primarily. And this can be done in various ways. We can make sure that environmental laws are written and interpreted in the correct ways, and there can always be improvements made to that. This can also be done by finding ways where the federal government and the state government sanction and approve of the management planning that we're doing, environmental management planning that we're doing. This can be done in the realm of the Endangered Species Act 4D limit, as you've heard about a couple times here, and as OFIC talked about in the state's effort to initiate a federal sanctioning and approval of the Oregon Plan. We would be in favor of that. It can also be done by implementing conservation measures on the ground. Conservation measures can also go hand in hand with technological advances for farming and ranching. And ultimately, in addition to minimizing environmental liabilities, those conservation efforts can lead to more efficient and cheaper ways to farm and ranch in the state. For example, I come from a farm family in Wasco County, and we grow primarily wheat and cattle ranching. And in the wheat industry, no-till farming has increasingly become an element of interest to control erosion and to ultimately make farming cheaper. And no-till farming involves transitioning from the old ways of farming of conventional plowing and going into a situation where you leave the prior year's stubble in place and you seed directly into the stubble for your new crop. That keeps the soil compacted, it keeps it together, and keeps it on the farm. That not only extensively controls erosion, which can lead to water quality issues, and it leaves the dirt in your farm, which for the long term is a necessary thing, and it controls the labor, and you only have to go around the fields a couple of times instead of plowing and then seeding, which where you have to use labor and additional machinery and fuels to get the crop in the ground and to do the necessary things you have to do for the next crop. So no-till farming is becoming increasingly popular as a conservation measure, but it's very expensive. You have to buy expensive machinery. Those machines are now costing anywhere from several hundred thousand dollars to $500,000 for the proper machinery needed, and you have to implement new ways of farming in order to implement a conservation measure like that. But that is something where it's beneficial to the public at large and the farming business, conservation measures like that. Irrigation improvements are also being used, which can ultimately lead to cheaper electricity prices, usage of less water by implementing conservation measures to decrease and more efficient use of water in irrigation farming. So conservation measures are something that we're particularly interested in, and getting the federal monies that are available through the federal farm bill and the state monies that are available through the Measure 66 funding and other types of federal and state grants that can be used to help farmers implement these things. Of course, conservation measures are completely reliant as well on proper planning at the local level. That is technical assistance and assistance in the planning of implementation of conservation measures at the local level through soil and water conservation districts and the NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service. Studies have shown that there is not enough technical assistance and management planning assistance at the local level to implement the conservation that we need and to make sure that we disproportionately get federal and state monies that Oregon needs to protect our environmental elements on the ground. So we are continuously looking for ways to make improvements for additional technical assistance and management planning through these agencies that I've just mentioned. So when it comes to the Oregon Plan, the Farm Bureau and its members have been fully engaged since the beginning, and we look forward to additional work on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Gene?
Yeah, one.
Representative Schomburg.
How many farmers right now are doing no-till plowing in Oregon or America, and then how many will be in the future? I mean, eventually, I've had the opportunity and the pleasure to spend my share of time behind the wheel of a tractor plowing, so I'm just kind of interested in this. Do you see all farmers, where it's reasonable for them to make this investment, going to no-till plowing eventually?
Chairman Jensen, Representative, I see it becoming more mainstream every year. It is, for some farmers, like my parents, they are in an experimental phase where we take 50 acres at a time and do no plowing and have it custom done by a neighbor who owns the machinery to do it, and looking to see and analyzing how those yields come out on that no-till patches that we do. And so there is a lot of experiments being done by farmers. Some farmers have fully purchased the machinery and fully have implemented no-till farming on their entire acreage. I see eventually if people get assistance with the purchase, the capital investment that's needed, and can see that they're able to raise a crop with that type of practice, I see everyone transitioning into no-till farming.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
If I may make comment in that regard, Representative Schaffler, there are other issues that come into play when you go to no-till farming, and they are perhaps different on the east side of the state as they are to the west side. When I, as a grass seed farmer, choose not to work the straw under after the annual grass seed has been combined, and I don't burn it, then that straw will lay on top of the ground through the winter and degrade. Now, that's all good, except that it also harbors, is a wonderful food source and harbors the existence of very small slugs. And those slugs tend to eat your field. And then you also end up with some disease issues, depending on the field, some weed species that become very difficult to control. What that means is that even though you're saving money and time and erosion issues, which are all good, by going to no-till, you may have to spend money additionally on pesticides, herbicides. So it's an interesting trade-off, and it really depends a lot on the practices of the farmer. Have they been a good farmer? Have they kept the fields reasonably clean? Rotational issues. But it is a good tool that we should have available in terms of being able to manage our cultural practices for the least amount of damage that may occur from things like erosion, which clearly impact the Oregon Plan.
Mr. Chair, just to add to that, I think that is just one example of many types of practices and new technologies or farm advances that can be used, but everything has to be lined up just right. The incentives have to be there. The research has to be done to make sure that the crop can be raised in using those tools, and the capital investment, you have to have assistance with that from sources. So things have to be lined up just right to implement some of these really important, broad-sweeping advances in agriculture today.
Thank you. I have one quick question for you, Gene. Does the Farm Bureau hire or have on staff technical folks that can assist your members? Because 10,000 members, I'm assuming, throughout the whole state. Having experience, worked for an SWCD, I know they're pretty strapped for resources. So do you have staff on board that can assist your members in implementing, say, the 10-10 plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, unfortunately, we don't. We've made some attempts, and we'll probably make some attempts in the future to get grant monies to provide some of that technical assistance. We have assistance, legal assistance, and those types of sources available to help people with their management planning. But as far as, you know, engineering to put projects out on the ground, we haven't been able to provide those services. We rely really on the work at the local level of soil and water conservation districts and NRCS to provide those services.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, okay, Josh, one more, please. The incentives and assistance as in tax credits for farmers here in Oregon, are those in place right now that would aid a farmer like yourself or your family or neighbors? Are those in place right now, or do we need more of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of those are in place. The Pollution Control Tax Credit Program was amended a couple sessions ago to include non-point pollution sources such as agriculture and ranching. And so those programs are available. What we are looking for this session is to provide some improvements to the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program, for example, so that it can be properly utilized by the agriculture industry. Primarily, my understanding is the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program is being used by farmers who implement practices rather than field burning. They cut the straw and store it in barns, and they've been able to utilize the program to implement those practices. But other types of practices like I'm speaking of, the program isn't being utilized for those and should be, and it was intended to be when the amendment was put in place a couple sessions ago. So we're looking to clarify that statute to make it to make sure that it's utilized the way it should be. We could certainly use other types of incentives, tax credit type incentives like this. And in this economy and budget crisis that we're in, I don't know how that's going to fly. But there are some people that have some ideas that want to add to that. Because, again, all these incentives, you know, line up to make it work. And tax incentives would be a crucial part of that.
Thank you very much, Jane, and we appreciate your testimony today. We'll probably see you frequently here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, as we at this point, we are ending our Oregon Plan educational program that we set out at the beginning. We'll be moving on to other issues after the field trip that you're going on, I think, Thursday. I hope that the committee has gained some insights into the overall Oregon plan, and the knowledge is a little greater now than it was when we started this. I do appreciate and recognize that some members of the committee, Representative Cruz as an example, has listened, I know, to the Oregon plan in a water committee now for four consecutive sessions. I also know Representative Cruz, is never one to not want to continue his learning process. So.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to say, as one of the new members that has been oft referred to throughout this particular education seminar, and I know I speak for Representative Schaffler as well, I really appreciate the background and the fundamental information. It's been very helpful.
Thank you very much, and with that, we are adjourned.